This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello and welcome to Teachers Talk Radio. My name's Adam Colbeck, and this is my very first show tonight. So thank you very much indeed for joining me. The plan tonight is to dive into the wonderful and colourful world of curriculum with Chris Passy, and see what Chris has to say about all things curriculum from his own context and from his experience
this
as well. So it should be a
great
evening
Teachers
Talk
Radio,
ahead. And hopefully
you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Wonderful. So as I said, I am joined tonight by Chris Passy. So Chris is the deputy head teacher of Comeechi School up in Birmingham. And among other things, Chris is also a former winner of the prestigious Teacher of the Year award. So hello, Chris.
Good evening, Adam. Hello.
You're there. You made me wait a couple of seconds there before I heard you say hello. That was like a real heart in the mouth moment. And you know it's my first show as well. You did that deliberately.
I didn't. I was unmuting myself. I was trying to stick to procedure. How are you?
Yeah, good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you. Very well.
Excellent. So tonight we're gonna dive into all things curriculum tonight.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. So are you prepared? Are you ready to go?
Yeah, I'm surrounded. I'm surrounded by books and knowledge and pens and the internet.
Good stuff. No cheating by looking up answers.
Fair enough. I understand.
All right. So before we sort of dive into any curriculum-based content then, do you want to start off just by telling everybody a little bit about you? What's your story?
Oh, yeah. So my story is I'm a deputy head and Senko at a small independent school in Birmingham. We're music specialists. Yeah, I've got the great pleasure of working really, really hard every day for the wonderful students that sit in front of me. And kind of, I came to teaching through performing arts and then into kind of the secondary school. And then I did a master's in educational leadership and kind of find myself with a couple of things to say. So thank you very much for having me as your guest tonight.
Did you meet anyone of note or of worth on the master's?
I may have met a couple of people, Adam. A couple of people that might be quite interesting. Yeah,
that's nice to hear, because we actually did, full disclosure, that is where we met, isn't it? So
it is where we met. Yes,
on our master's degree. So yeah, wonderful experience for lots of reasons. Least not that. So yeah, okay. So we've heard a little bit about your context. Can you tell us a little bit more just about the school and about kind of your role specifically within the curriculum there, before we sort of get into loads of detail, just a bit more context about the school itself.
Of course, so we're, like I said, we're a small independent school, but it's the status is important because we get a lot of young people from around, around the Midlands, I guess, and they come from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of school situations. Some have had school trauma, some have been emotional-based school refusers, and some young people just want to come to a school that kind of focuses on music. So the idea of what does a curriculum look like in our school can be quite a complex one. And so my role within the school with their head teacher, Sally, we kind of co-lead on curriculum and make sure that whatever's being taught in school is being learned, first and foremost, but that whatever's being taught is sequenced well enough to be able to capture a wide range of backgrounds, contexts, cultural knowledge, cultural capital, all of those kinds of things. So it's a melting pot, and curriculum design is at the very heart of that for us.
Yeah, totally. Because I mean, ultimately, the curriculum is the entire lived experience of the children in the school, right? And so yeah, the curriculum has always got to reflect that context that you've got coming into you. And it does. I know from conversations that we've had previously that your context is super, super unique and quite demanding in many ways as well, and also quite varied. And I guess that has to be reflected in all of your curriculum design decisions as well.
Yeah, because you've got you've got to capture as many people as possible, haven't you? You've got to make sure that we've got high expectations of everybody that's in the room, regardless of their background.
Fantastic. And in terms of, just before we get into a little bit more detail on it then, in terms of you individually, what are your passions? So I know you said that you trained as a peripatetic music teacher before coming into school. What are your kind of personal passions?
My personal passions, I am a very keen musician. I like doing a lot of singing. I think I've just signed up to run the marathon again. I only did that once. But I got serious FOMO yesterday watching everybody doing it, so I thought I'd have a bit of a go on that. I just like, my other passion is English, so that's probably going to be the crux of our conversation tonight and the English curriculum that we have in school. But my passion lies at the moment around leadership, educational leadership, and what kind of contexts and nuances are required to really see good, decent school leadership succeed in the most complicated and complex of situations.
I just want to pick up on the fact there that you just basically said you had fear of missing out, and so you signed up to the marathon. I think
yes, that'll give listeners a bit of an insight into how I work. Yeah.
Yeah, I bet. And talking of listeners, I mean, I'm sure as we talk through, there'll be loads of questions and thoughts that come to people's minds. And so please do feel free to call in and text in with your questions for Chris. And let's see if we can't dig as far into his brilliant curriculum brain as we possibly can. So Chris, with your curriculum at Comici, do you want to just start off by telling us, what was it like before? What's the journey that it's been on up to the point of you doing the most sort of significant piece of work that I know you've done fairly recently on it?
So the curriculum was perfectly serviceable. Everybody was getting the results that they wanted. And I don't want to undo the hard work of myself and anybody else at the school while we were working hard to get the young people in front of us to get them to pass their exams. You know, we were faced with COVID that was changing a lot of things. We were faced with the change that came in 2015, where we had this new linear type of assessment at GCSE. I was happy trucking along with the books we'd chosen and the discrete skills that the discipline brings. But I was beginning to fall out of love with the books. The kids were not impassioned. They were learning keywords. They were learning key phrases. And the turning point for me was a young lad who came out of the exam and he went, sir, it was Woman in Black. I was like, yes, I know that. I saw it. And he was like, yeah, it was Woman in Black. And I wrote down foreshadowing. I wrote down pathetic fallacy and a couple of other things. I was like, right, that's great. Did you just write them on the paper? Or did you write them, like, where did you use them correctly? And he spoke me through it. And actually, he got a 6 in the end. And I think it's perfectly okay to have a curriculum that serves the needs of the young people, if that is, you know, passing their exams. And you can get a good mark on having these discrete islands of knowledge. You just have them and you go, I've learnt all of the quotes for Pride and Prejudice. I've learnt the characters. I've learnt the plot. I've memorised it. And now I'm going to use it to hopefully try and answer an exam. But the young people that are with us and I guess the reason why I agreed to come on and talk about this, so it wasn't, you know, literally just about my setting, but it was about the idea that perhaps something that was a curriculum that gave a bit of meaning to their lives as well as humans, to kind of, as you said earlier, bring their lived experience to it. And I was quite influenced by some podcasts that I listened to and some books that I'd read. There's a work by Zoe Hellman and Sam Gibbs that was quite influential. Where one of the quotes was, "There is intrinsic value in meaning making." And I, at the end of the exam, I remember sitting down with Sally and just saying, "I don't. It's going well. They're learning. They're passing their exams. But I think we could go further, because we were having those chats. I don't know whether you and the listeners are familiar with that." It's either a meme or, but you've got the man staring out of the window. and it's the windows, the curtains are blue, and it says, you know, the man says out of a blue curtain window, teacher says the blue is there reflective of his existential crisis of loneliness, and the writer is going, no, the curtains are just blue. And, you know, so the all the kids are going, yeah, can it not just be that the author decided that it was blue? And what I realised was that, you know, yes, absolutely. But the meaning that they create, their context that they put onto that image, that their own cultural capital and their lived experience that they bring to that moment to go, why could it be blue? Why isn't it this colour? Why is it, you know, is it velvet? Is it material, and that's reflective of something. If they're coming up with that and they're doing the thinking, that's magic. That's the discipline of English. It's what teachers look out for. It's what examiners look out for, and it's less of a box ticking exercise. And the young people that leave us, and young people that leave a more curriculum based, a concept based curriculum, have the potential to look at their own lives in a different way, to see people differently, to see the world differently, to see it through the eyes of complexity and nuance, and not just, it was just a blue curtain.
It's funny, actually, before you mentioned the word yourself, just listening to some of the other stuff that you'd said before that, I wrote down the word meaning and underlined it a couple of times, and then out from your mouth came the word meaning as well. And I think that comes across really, really strongly in everything you've just talked about there. It's about trying to take these disconnected pieces of knowledge that are being learned or memorized, as you said, depending on what your view is, that are being learned or memorized for the purpose of that exam, and then going, actually, there's a layer of meaning that sits behind all of this stuff that makes it worthwhile to be learned and worthwhile to be thought about, right? Because it's the amount of time that that students spend thinking about this content is quite substantial. And so if you can make sure that what they're thinking about has deeper meaning, then all the better, right?
But we've got such a limited amount of time to get such a lot of information. You know, there's a lot of curriculum content to cover. And by curriculum content, let's not beat around the bush. What we're talking about is there's a lot of things to learn to pass the exam. And there's a lot of content to cover. But I think sometimes taking the time off to talk about the human experience and what reasons why the author may have written something in a certain way, or reasons why you have assumed it's this, the reasons that you have given this a certain meaning, to see the look in their faces of, oh no, that is worthwhile, I guess. I hadn't thought of it like that. There was a young lad, he's just about to sit his GCSE, isn't he? He'd read an unseen poem. It's called The Butterfly, I think. And then there was another poem that he had to compare it to. And he said, I think that the butterfly, this is possibly the writer could be experiencing a change of personality or a lack of identity. Now, it isn't what the poem was about, not really, but that didn't matter. And I made sure that he didn't know. I made sure that he knew it didn't matter, that his meaning that he'd made within that poem and the reasons he gave, and the writer's written it in this way, I think, because of A, B, and C, which means X, Y, Z. I can't tell him no. I can guide him towards, an examiner might like you to word it in this way, but specifically in a kind of an English literature poetry, unseen poetry exam, if he can back up what he's saying with evidence from the text and it's his own meaning making, I can't see an examiner really marking that wrong. Plus he's become a bit of a better human being for it. You know, he's looking at that little bit deeper. And I think that's a great thing.
Without doubt. And it's the thinking that he's doing that's important there as well. It's not all about the outcome, delivering that answer, delivering that outcome. Sometimes the value is in the process, and by creating something that enables them to think at that depth, you're adding enormous value in that way. Okay, so far then, we've talked about this drive for meaning and this need to kind of develop intrinsic value in the curriculum that you're creating, and it's not just there to serve the exam, but it is, you know, it's there to push this wider meaning and this understanding of these bigger things that go beyond just the content that is being taught. So you wanted to do both of those two things, but you didn't want to sacrifice the content at the same time. Does that kind of sum up where you're up to so far?
Yeah, beautifully.
In that case, then, if we will pick up on the next part of this conversation after a few words from our valued sponsors and supporters.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by Teachwell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Think I'm back there, sorry. So we talked so far then, Chris, about meaning and intrinsic value, but wanting to achieve both of those things with your curriculum, but not sacrifice the value of the content as well. So that's what brought you to this idea of concept-driven curriculum. So what is a concept? At the heart of it, and at the heart of this curriculum thinking, what is a concept?
Well, and I think it's important to kind of say this to begin with. This was something that I thought I was coming up with on my own. I was like, what am I trying to find out here? What am I trying to pin down? And I think what I was trying to get about the idea of what is a concept is that a concept was a broad umbrella, a broad church of knowledge that you're able to hang different pieces of information off, whether that's discrete knowledge, whether that's previous knowledge, schema. They are in themselves islands, but that are connected through the subject discipline. It's difficult because concepts have different meanings for everybody. And I think if I said to you, or you know, what is a concept in maths? I think that's going to be a more difficult conversation than what is a concept in English, or what is a concept in history, or more of those language based things. I think trying to pin it down is hard because concepts are intrinsically abstract.
Yeah.
And their conceptions, their notions, their pieces of information that I believe when tackled properly, a student will be able to join a school at 12 and leave at 16 with an enriched knowledge of their subject, the ability to pass the exam, but also, as we've said, the power to make meaning where that's powerful and important.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, and personally, I'd fully concur with that. I love the idea that you've come up with there about it being like an island, but you know, a concept, each concept sort of beginning as an island, but then almost having these connections that are built off of that island as well. Really like that. And I know we're probably going to end up getting into a little bit of research chat later. And I know that David Ajabel's research and work and Sarah Cottingham's kind of translation into the Modern in Action series has influenced a lot of your thinking as well. But I know that that's not where your thinking on this started, and that it would be very amiss of us to not talk about Sam Gibbs and the influence that she had on your thinking around this particular area.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, teachers are bettered by their peers. Teachers are we're better when we chat to each other, when we talk, and this idea of an island is going to keep coming up because I felt quite isolated in thinking about this, in wondering how I could get my students to make meaning. I said to them when I introduced it to them, to my year 11s, at the beginning of this academic year, I said, at the moment, you're reading a passage that says, the man has a cat, and you're being asked for evidence of what the man is doing in his life, and you're all saying, the man has a cat. Brilliant, that's your point. Where's your, if we go back to the really old, the PEE, point, evidence, and explanation. So there's your point, he's got a cat. Where's your evidence? The quote, cat. And what's the explanation? The man has a cat. And I said, all of that is fine, but what I want you to do is tell me that the writer has chosen the cat as potentially a bit of an idea around symbolism of loneliness, possibly. Do people thinking that owning cats is a lonely thing? It isn't. But is that where the writer's going? Does he want to tell you that through his choice of pet, the man is alone?
Yeah, love it. And again, that kind of ties into what you were saying previously as well about the fact that it's, you know, these concepts in themselves tend to start off really abstract, and perhaps they become more concrete with each kind of example and experience of that concept. But the core concept itself remains abstract all the way through.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, we haven't even got onto concepts yet. You know, we're still talking about trying to make deeper meaning. Which only comes from a source of rich knowledge within the curriculum. So, like, if we're to get them to understand the abstract, then they need to have an understanding about the concrete, and that is something that's fundamental. Something that I chatted to, or at least have had some communication with Sam about. And in discovering that people like Sam Gibbs and David Didow, and that there's other people out there who are doing outstanding work on something that I was already struggling with. So I just bought the books and I dove straight in, and I bought loads of other stuff. You know, you go for your research, don't you? You go for where you want to go. And I spoke to you, I spoke to Sally, I spoke to other teachers, and I still wasn't finding the right kind of language to use with our young people, for them to be coming out at year 11 with better marks, but a deeper understanding of what they were learning.
And it's the thing that comes through from you all the time, and I think is coming across really, really clearly in everything that you've said so far, is this sort of real commitment to making sure that the young people that you're teaching finish at the end of year 11 with that deeper understanding of how the world works, and in your, you know, within your subject within English, a deeper understanding of how literature kind of comes to be and how it fits together, which is a wholeheartedly more complex commitment than just getting them through passing the exam. I mean, you're very good at doing that as well, but it does seem that this commitment to creating this curriculum that's built around key concepts that continually revisited as students move through the curriculum, it feels like that is very much rooted in your overall aim to help them understand the way the world is as much as it is to help them pass the exam, because that exam result is also going to be useful to them as they go on into later life.
Yeah, and I think it's important to own my privilege, you know, very small. And yes, it's got a wide variety of, as we've said, cultural capital and backgrounds and send and knowledge or lack of knowledge, prior knowledge. The class sizes are small enough to have almost experimental style curriculum. We've got time to get things wrong, get things right. Not putting anybody's education at risk. You know, we don't have a lot of time, and I do believe that time should be spent in lessons teaching, and it should be spent teaching the knowledge that needs to be there. But as I said right at the beginning, our young people come from such an array of backgrounds, they might not know that quite a trite symbol for loneliness could be putting a cat with somebody in a house. So I would have a conversation with them and say, if you know that every single book you have read is the result of an author deciding to do this, then making these active choices, then you know that the lady living in the flat on the top floor with a cat, I love cats, by the way. This is nothing about, I've just picked it. Let's go dog. So there's a lady living in a flat on her own with a dog, and she's looking out of a window. As the writer, what are we saying here? Why have they done this? And the conversations that happen are varied because we change the animal. So let's go for dogs are loyal and, you know, let's go stereotypical. You know, is the author making use of stereotypes here? Is the author playing on our knowledge of stereotypes? And the dog is loyal, so the dog sits there, and then the woman turns to her husband and says, you know, please don't go to war. And he goes, I've got to, and he leaves. I said to them, what does that make you feel about the husband? Oh, and they've got nothing much. I was like, okay, not a problem. Here we go. Let's tell the story again. But this time the husband turns and says, I've got to go to war. And the wife says, but what about the baby? And the man turns back and says, I'll build the nursery when I return. And I said, what's going to happen to him? And they all went, dead. And I was like, yep, he's going to die. He's going to die. Because the author has used a little trick there. They've used the fact that we are now more emotionally invested in this character. We don't want the man to die. He's definitely going to die, though, because he's having a baby. And that just makes it a better way of telling the story. And their eyes light up when they're like, wait, so the author, they did that on purpose. So then you compare it to the one where you said, well, there was no baby and he just walked out. The author didn't make you invested in the character. The author didn't make you think about the dog and how sad the dog would be that his master wasn't coming back. And it's these moments that will equip them when they have an unread or an unseen element in their exam. It also happens with the apathy with poetry as well.
Yeah, because ultimately what you're doing is creating these connected webs of knowledge, right? So instead of it being on its own, you're teaching connected knowledge. And you're teaching that through the continued exposure to lots of different experiences and lots of different examples of where that concept can be seen being played out in real life literature that's on the page right in front of them the whole time. And you're teaching them to spot those connections, right?
Absolutely. To bounce back dipping a toe into Azubel, it's taking that prior knowledge. And if they don't have the prior knowledge I need them to have, like basically as I've just done with you, I will explicitly speak about dogs and the symbolism behind dogs, the deliberate choices that the author has made. And that's building prior knowledge that they might not have. It's adding to the prior knowledge that will be bought by students who already have it. And then I bring into the idea about the author creating and the new bit of knowledge that comes out, the new bit of learning is maybe that in my story, in my creative writing, I can use an animal to elicit an empathetic response. Or when I read Macbeth and Lady Macbeth is having her breakdown just before her suicide, has Shakespeare done that to make me feel sorry for her? Has he done that to make me realize that she's not as evil as I thought she was, which is, you know, that's quite a basic concept. So I know I'm bouncing around here, but you're right, it's connected webs of knowledge, and it's so unfair to expect our students to understand our curricula as much as we do. we've got to take them there. We've got to guide them through it. We've got to make sure that they are looking like a writer. They are looking like an examiner. And so to that extent, a lot of the exercises I do with all of my year groups is I get them to write a story, a very short story, but I get them to use specific symbols that mean specific things. So that when they write it, it's easier to spot in another piece of writing from other authors.
So is a, and there's clearly a really big link then between broad concepts that you want to build the curriculum around and this idea of symbolism. But what's the difference then between a concept and an example of symbolism?
Well, in our school, we look at and we take the Zoe and Sam's threshold concepts or foundational concepts, principally around that texts are constructs. And I remember trying to teach this before I'd seen this this substantial work. And I try to explain it in a way, you know, that he's doing it on purpose. So in all of their books, if you'd have seen it a couple of years ago, they'd have at the title at the top of each page, nothing is done by accident, everything is done on purpose. So I'd already kind of got that seed of an idea that authors are going to be using these tricks and these tools to say something on purpose, to give us a message intentionally, and they're going to use these to elicit a response from an audience member or a reader or a writer. And I often say that if you're reading something by an author, it's like picking the phone up to them. What are they directly trying to tell you? You're on the phone to Will. What's he saying to you right now when we've got this scene in Othello? What, you know, Emilia's just lied to Desdemona about the handkerchief. She knows where it is. She's about to give it to her weird husband. Why has she done that? Oh, I don't know, sir. It's very weird. Yeah, it is. Why? What's going on? Pick up the phone to Will. Why has he done that? What has been added by his choice? And it's really important to me that the language isn't Desdemona has done this or Othello's wife. I'm now having a panic. I don't think she's called Emilia. I'm panicking. Anyway, I'll come back to that. It's something very similar.
I'll bow to your superior knowledge of Shakespeare.
No, please don't, because I'm going to have to Google that now. Oh, for the shame. I was right. It's Emilia. Making me
the relief.
The relief. As everybody just turned off, the audience went down to zero. Sam and Zoe mentioned this in their work as well, and then I speak to the kids about it. Where I'm like, and by their work, I mean the work they're doing in schools across the country, but the work that all English teachers are working towards is the fact that Macbeth isn't about a man in Scotland, right? I'll get slightly detailed now. So it's not about a man in Scotland who wants to be king. It is a vehicle. Macbeth himself is a vehicle for showing that absolute power can corrupt absolutely. He is.
Macbeth is the symbol then, right?
Macbeth is bigger than that. Macbeth is the actual driving force. He is the vehicle. He is the thing that Shakespeare uses in the context to say, be kind to your new king, right? Mm-hmm. So Elizabeth has died. She's rumoured to have nodded to give King James the throne of England as well as Scotland. Macbeth gets picked up as a king's player. And one of the first things he writes is a play about don't murder a king, this could happen to you. It's so obvious that he didn't just sit in his bedroom and go, I've got a cracking story about a murderous man. It's used. Yeah. And once young people understand that, I think, and I know others do as well, that is a fundamental thing they've come across, that Macbeth has done this on purpose to warn the people of the early 1600s to not rise up against your king, because if you are ambitious, he says, you know, Macbeth himself says that ambition is the thing that will o-leap itself and fall onto the other. Like, I don't need to do this, but my ambition's going to make me. And if you come at Macbeth with the young people, like, I'm going to tell you a really cool story about revenge and death, and it's really cool, I don't think it has the same power as going, Shakespeare is giving a secret warning to everybody. Don't be too ambitious. It'll get you killed. And that fundamentally, for me, is more exciting. And then as the teacher in the room, if I can convey that excitement, if I can convey that passion and that that knowledge to the young people in front of me, then I think we're kind of on the way to winning half the battle.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess you're right. I mean, it's so Macbeth, the character of Macbeth, he sort of symbolises that in the example you just gave. So he would symbolise this idea around power potentially corrupting people. And so that concept of, you know, power can corrupt, that would be a concept that would continually be revisited over the course of a child's journey through your curriculum?
Yeah, so to go specifically into what we do, we've selected our GCSE texts And then what I do is I look at what are the main themes that come up across our books. So we're doing Christmas Carol, The Woman in Black, and Macbeth. And those three texts, they're changed. We've just done Othello, and we've just done Pride and Prejudice. So we're jumping in and out of one. Woman in Black's about to be retired for something else. So we've got gender roles. We've got power, absolutely power and ambition. We've got love and passion. We've got revenge and betrayal. We've got, as I said, gender roles and responsibilities, the supernatural and the unknown. These themes are going to be the concepts that need to be spoken about in an exam to be able to answer it fully, so that you can talk about another section of the play that you're going to be asked about. Remember, with these linear examinations, you get all three books asked at once, in the space of a couple of weeks, two books and poetry you've read and 18 poems you've learnt, and then, you know, it's so end loaded, it's mad. So to be able to give them the gift of remember what links them all, remember what links everything in Macbeth together, are these themes and topics. And then what we've done is we run that back all the way through to year five. So we start at year five and we go through to year 13. And I'm a really big advocate for having primary schools talking to their secondary schools. Where are your holes? Where are the gaps in the knowledge? Where are the gaps in the prior knowledge? What can I equip my year sixes with? So when they come into year seven, they can have a conversation about gender roles and responsibility. And then they can have, and we'll look at a book about gender roles and responsibility. And then in year eight, we will have a look at this poetry that has a bit of gender roles and responsibility. The idea being, so we don't get people too bored, the idea being that by the time they sit down in our year nine and begin to look at their GCSE texts, and we say, we're going to look at the role of Lady Macbeth, they're already thinking, this is the idea, this is the plan, they're already thinking, the gender roles and responsibility, how is Lady Macbeth being portrayed here, is and where we want them to go is Shakespeare a proto-feminist? Was he there before anybody else? He's given Lady Macbeth agency, he's given her choices, he's given her power, and that's how the curriculum for English works across the school at the moment. And so we've got year seven, I think they're just the BFG, and I know there's a bit of a kickback about Roald Dahl. We only have one Roald Dahl book per any season, and they've gone for the BFG because they were looking at the supernatural and just themes and symbols that you might look with the supernatural, you might find with the supernatural, but also relationships and the human experience, the character of Sophie and how she treats the giant. These concepts, if taught early enough, will pick up a bit hinterlandy. You know, will pick up on these really cool little pieces of knowledge. I always remember in Bennett's The History Boys, you know, they're talking about, he's asking about different body parts of Jesus, and he's, what's that got to do with the essay, sir? He's like, nothing, but it's interesting, isn't it? It's an interesting piece of, it's a fact and can help build that knowledge-rich background, so that our young people, that no matter where they've come from, if they're given the prior knowledge of what I'm expecting them to adapt to when it comes to conceptual themes, they're all going to come at it from a level playing field eventually. And these methods are great for kids with dyslexia. They're great for all different types of SEND. It helps that I'm the SENCO at the school as well. So I'm able to weave that in. But do you know what? What works for those students, what works for our most disadvantaged students, works for all of our students.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that works for most settings, unless we're looking at something incredibly specific. And, you know, if anybody out there is listening, they want to, you know, drop us a tweet or whatever and call me out and go, I don't think that's right, but maybe it's a hill I will approach myself. Not necessarily to die on, but it's a hill I will approach, that I really think that, like in society, how you treat your most vulnerable is a reflection of how you how you are in the world, and I think how you treat your SEND young people, your disadvantaged young people, the ones that might be lacking cultural capital, might be lacking that prior knowledge, opening that base of parity for them all will help the top end just as much as you'll be able to push those, because the ones at the top are likely to go, oh yeah, well, the Lady Macbeth, she has got her own agency here, but it's falling apart because the symbol of the blood on her hands, and we know that's the symbol of guilt, we know it's a symbol of well, it's actually the manifestation of the guilt on her hands. That's what I want them to be talking about, and they can access that pretty quickly. But it's not such a highfalutin concept that can't be taught to the, I hate the bottom of it, you know what I mean? They can't be taught to those who aren't yet able to access that, because that can be taught explicitly, right?
You know, those without the prior knowledge already in place that will enable them to make those connections. You're right. If you teach it to them explicitly, then you provide them with that access as well, which is great. I mean, what you were saying there really it reminded me of so we plan our curriculum similarly at the school that I work at around key concepts, and we do that. It's a primary school, and we do that across all subjects. And we've had comments from secondary schools, just not by design actually, and it would be wonderful if we could do it by design, but by chance. One of the key concepts within our history curriculum is monarchy. And one of the secondary schools that a lot of our year sixes go to, they're one of their units in year seven, and I forget which unit of work it is, but it leans heavily. I think it might actually be like the Reformation actually, that they do. And so obviously it leans heavily on this idea of monarchy and the role of the monarchy in relation to the church. And how, you know, the church and the monarchy have kind of exchanged power over and throughout history, and they've commented that our kids who go to them for year seven are particularly well prepared for that very first unit, because they've got this quite interconnected, well developed understanding of monarchy, just because they study it repeatedly all the way through from year one to year six. And so they get that really sort of sophisticated, interconnected understanding of it, which they're then ready to apply. So absolutely. I mean, I completely concur with everything you're saying there. One of the concepts that you mentioned was gender roles. Can you just give us a bit of a summary then from year five, right the way up to, is it year 13 you go to?
We take up to year 13. English goes up to, at the moment, because nobody's doing A-level English, shock. We're actually just going up to year 11, I know. That is something I'm hoping to change with this love of reading. But just before I jump into that, the one thing I did want to say was about, very specifically about writing, and the influence this has on their writing is profound. And was actually commented on by an inspection we recently had, that the impact of this being in what was just a term and a half was quite outstanding. And what was happening was, if I wanted them to explicitly understand what a concept or a theme or a symbol was going to do, I would get them to write it in a story. I would say to them, we're going to do a small write, maybe just a page, and I want you to write about an excited child who gets lost in a park. And they would do that. I wouldn't give them very much scaffolding, because we got enough time within the lesson to begin that write without very much scaffolding, and then jump back into them and be like, show me what you've got. Let's do some sharing. That's another thing that, you know, they don't mind sharing their work. And what comes from that is that, okay, so there's a boy, he's in the park, and he's on the swings, and he's got no friends. And like, that's very sad. It's just very factual. There's not a lot there. There's not a lot of emotion. And then we go, if you were an author and you were trying to make your audience feel something, what are you trying to make them feel? I want them to know that the boy is lonely. What could you do in that playground to emphasize the fact that he's lonely. What could you put in there? Oh, an empty swing swinging. You could comment on it. Yes, you could. You could comment on an empty swing on its own. Could you hear laughter in the distance? Could some leaves blow by or some people run past and stop and stare at him and laugh and run off again? And then we would all agree on three different things to try and get into the story that might make that meaning more explicit to the reader. And the writing, day on day, week on week, then becomes full of these, admittedly, to further down the school, contrived pieces of writing that are very kind of making it clear what the intention is. But as they go up the school and as we do more and more practices of these, it becomes more nuanced, it becomes more implicit. So metaphor, rhetoric, that gets used a lot more. We talk about how the use of empathy can really, really help audiences feel sorry for the boy, and that's what we want. And so writing across the school has improved vastly as a result.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, and particularly from the point of view of the English curriculum as well.
Yeah,
there's that phrase, and I forget where I've heard it, but this phrase that reading is breathing in and writing is breathing out, and that idea actually you kind of gone.
No, you heard it from me, but I don't know where I heard it from.
There you go. It's beautiful because it really does encapsulate everything that you're saying here. It's about, you know, you're giving them this experience of all of these different concepts, and you're giving them lots and lots of different examples of where that concept can be seen in literature and where it's symbolized in different ways in literature as well. So you're kind of really broadening the parameters of what these concepts are. And then you're going, right, now you've got that understanding from what you've read, now go and put that into practice within your own writing. And so what it does beautifully, by the sounds of it, and I know this is the case with your school as well, is it creates that cyclical understanding of reading and writing being together as one subject, English.
Yes, correct. And by the way, it was American literature specialist Pam Allen who said, "If reading is breathing in, then writing is breathing out."
Thank you, Pam. And yeah. I think with that, we'll go to our sponsors again, and we'll also have the news on this one. And then when we come back, perhaps you can give us a bit of a run through of pick a concept, any concept, and talk us through from kind of year 5 to year 11 what it looks like. Does that sound all right?
It'd be my pleasure.
Awesome. Right, here we go.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
According to reports on the BBC News website, the EU wants to agree a deal with the UK that would make it easier for people aged between 18 and 30 to study abroad in the wake of Brexit. The European Commission says it would be a limited arrangement, not the restoration of freedom of movement. The UK already has schemes with some non-EU countries, and these allow people to come to the UK for up to 2 years. Downing Street says it's open to extending this to individual EU members rather than throughout the EU, but prefers country-by-country deals. The proposed EU scheme has time limits, and UK participants would only be able to stay in the EU country that accepted them. The report goes on to say that it would reduce controls on young people moving between the UK and EU. The European Commission says it is stepping in after the UK approached several EU countries to discuss deals. The Commission says it risked differential treatment of EU citizens and there should be a bloc-wide deal for equality. The UK turned down an offer to continue participating in the EU's Erasmus student exchange after Brexit, but did replace it with the Turing scheme, which provides exchanges worldwide. The BBC South East team have covered concerns expressed by some students that they may run out of ADHD medication during the upcoming exam period. Some students have reported rationing their medication in order to stretch it out following reports of shortages due to an increase in demand and manufacturing issues. ADHD medications are often controlled drugs, which means prescriptions are limited to a month's supply, although some pharmacies also struggle to fill even this. The NHS advises against any changes of dosage without medical advice, but families continue to feel anxious about the possibility of young people struggling through the exam season. The Guardian reports on findings from communications regulator Ofcom, which suggests that a quarter of 3- and 4-year-olds in the UK now own a smartphone. Half of children under 13 are on social media. Online activity by infant school-aged children is rising. These findings could boost the argument of those urging the government to clamp down on social media and phone use by young children. A consultation will likely be launched in coming weeks, according to sources in government. This could include a proposal to ban mobile phone sales to under 16s, one to make it easier for parents to use parental controls on devices, and one to raise the minimum age for social media sites from 13 to 16. Michelle Donlan, Technology Secretary, said children as young as 5 should not be accessing social media. The Ofcom figures come amid what The Guardian says is growing evidence of the impact of social media use amongst children, and the US government refers to it as a profound risk to mental health. The book The Anxious Generation, published in March by a US academic, has been cited as influencing thinking in number 10. The Ofcom survey was based on 2,480 parents of children aged between 3 and 17. The TES reports that absence rates are up again according to latest DfE figures. This is compared with spring 2022-23. This is despite the government's ongoing attendance drive. Overall absence for last term was 7.3%, slightly up on the 7% in the previous year. The Department for Education said the rise was likely to have been caused by a higher level of illness absence. The proportion of persistently absent pupils has also slightly increased to 21.9% of pupils who were missing 10% or more half days. The figures for disadvantaged pupils are worse when compared to their peers. Full details of the latest data can be found on TES.com. Finally, the TES also features a report that the Department for Education does not intend to replace current progress measures, known as Progress 8, for the next 2 years. After exploring alternatives, there will be no progress measures published for schools in England in 2024-25 or 2025-26. The cancellation of Year 6 SATs during the pandemic meant that there was no Key Stage 2 attainment data available as a baseline for Progress 8 calculations. Headline attainment measures will still be published and grading will take place as normal. The Department for Education says it intends to return to Progress 8 in 2026-27. Teaching unions welcomed the announcement, but some described it as a missed opportunity to rethink performance tables overall. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Okay, so Chris, we got up to this this idea then of these key concepts that you took from. You started off thinking about the key concepts that were needed to pass that exam or to do well in that exam at the end of year 11, and then you backward planned from there right the way back to year 5, because that's where your school has its intake. So if we now go the other way, so from year 5 up to year 11. Can you just take us through the journey of one particular concept, a concept of your choosing, and just describe to us how you develop it and make sure that it progresses from one year to the next?
Yeah, of course. So very specifically in my setting, year 5 and year 6 are together, which just works for our young people. And the one I'll go with is the one that you suggested, gender roles and relationships. So for us, the examination of gender roles and relationships is a common theme that is found in the three books at the moment, Pride and Prejudice, Woman in Black and Macbeth. For me, it's clear that each text explores how the characters navigate social expectations related to their gender and the impact of these expectations on relationships that they have within the stories. So the first time that year 5 may come across this idea of gender roles and relationships is in a book called Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls. We do that through a lens of genre and theme. So they'll look at this book, which is a non-fiction book. The teachers will talk explicitly about gender roles, as will need to be explained later on. It's a hot topic at the moment, obviously. So we will be more looking at, in this context, traditional gender roles that could then be spoken about in the books that they'll be learning. They come across that idea again, gender roles and relationships in year 7. So you say year 5 and year 6, that's a bit kind of up in the air. They may come back to that same concept, but with a different book. We change the books all the time. We don't read full texts. It's quite controversial, but in an effort to encourage reading, we do sections, carefully curated in sections of books that prove the point that we're looking for. What that's actually done, rather interestingly, it's got students to go, well, can I read the rest of the book, please? As opposed to, here's the book, you're definitely going to read it. It's, as I said, owning my own privilege, very small setting, we can take these little risks and see whether they work. And at the moment, reading is up in school, or at least the can I do some reading, the choice to. So year 7, they'll look at gender roles and relationships through some poetry and through some language work. And that poetry will be down to the teacher to choose, but as long as it's got an idea of gender roles and relationships. And it tends to stay away from any of the GCSE stuff. Some of the really good stuff that David Didow talks about is not ensuring that everything is GCSE focused. A lot of his work is about, which I really admire, it starts early, and you start in year 7 with the earliest types of writing, and as you move up towards GCSE you get more and more modern. I think that's brilliant, and something I might look to do in my setting, but moving mountains one at a time. And so then might do that through some poetry. Then in year 8, gender roles and relationships comes up again, but we'll look at rhetoric this time in a book called 13. And so they're building up ideas of genre and theme, how that's used in gender roles and relationships, rhetoric, how that is used through this book. And then by the time we hit, we start talking about Pride and Prejudice, and indeed Macbeth, and the Woman in Black, they're like, oh yeah, women in society, the role of Lady Macbeth in the context. So we'll build up some explicit knowledge about Jacobean England. We'll build up some subject knowledge and prior knowledge about women's roles and abortions and children out of wedlock for the Woman in Black, and the shame of unmarried pregnancy, and then into Pride and Prejudice, which is all about gender roles and relationships. And as I said, the prize being that you don't start the conversation saying that the character of the Woman in Black is she's a woman and it's in this day and age and she suffers this. She should, the young people should be able to begin to hook on to, from their own prior knowledge, the schemas built up about what an author might do to tell us about the gender roles and relationships. So they become like mini investigators. They know what they're looking for. They know that an author, if they want to talk to us about a power imbalance, they're going to use structure for that. They're going to use hierarchical structure. They're going to use structure within the piece itself, how it is written and the form. They're also going to be looking for symbols. They're going to be looking for different ways of speaking. They're going to be hunting for those things. So in the exam, they can say that Susan Hill uses the character of the woman in black as a vehicle for this. The symbolism here, she uses this very specific word, the tolling of the bell at this point, which happens later on. And all of a sudden, you've got a young person talking knowledgeably about the book, which is important for the exam and to pass that. But they're also talking about things that are implicit within it. And all of a sudden, their answers are so much richer. And you know what, their communication in class is so much richer because they're thinking deeper about the concepts. They're thinking more about these foundational truths that live inside all of these texts that they're studying. And I can have the conversation, why has Shakespeare chosen to do this? Because when they get their exam, it'll say, seeing Othello and Desdemona declare their love for each other. You just answered a question about that. Think about their relationship throughout the play and write about it. And that'll be all they get. So what do we want? Do we want them to be hunting down the quotes? Yes, but those quotes have got to be hooked onto something, right? So that isolated island of knowledge, instead of just spouting out a black ram tupping a white ewe. Yeah, that's great. That's a quote from Othello. What's that got to do with gender roles and relationships? But if they can say, well, you know, Shakespeare's use of language here is quite racist. It's at least for our tastes now, and that could be a constant you that is a symbolism for innocence. Black ram, that's violent. That's we're talking about something that's really quite visceral here. And why Shakespeare has chosen these words and this imagery on purpose. As soon as a young person starts talking English in that way, they're already not only ticking the boxes for passing the exam, but they're kind of declaring their place within the human race. If that doesn't sound too highbrow, they're taking the claim.
It's ambitious stuff.
Oh, listen, but I think curriculums have to be ambitious, don't they? We can't be having curricula that just tick the box. That's not what we're talking about. And I remember when at my GCSEs, I remember that a fugue is a contrapuntal structure which makes much use of imitative entry. Now, I know what that means now, but did they... I didn't then. I just learned it by rote. That's how I can spit it out now. I have to think innately about what imitative entry as opposed to just spitting it back out because I learned it by rote. And guess what? I wasn't even asked that in my exam, so I wrote it on the front of my paper. I was so annoyed. You know, that's not what we want. That kind of knowledge might pass exams, but I'm not in it for that.
And it sounds like as well, like, you know, when you were talking earlier about like the broad concept, and so that's kind of like your island, and then you've got the different examples of where that concept is at play in the literature that they read. It almost feels like what you're then saying is that the place of the quote, if you like, which is otherwise just becomes the obsession, because the way to pass the exam is by putting the quote in. The quote almost becomes your bridge between your concept and your example of that concept in action.
Yeah,
is that about
that's why. I don't use P in school. We don't use point, evidence, explain, or peel or anything like that, because you don't need to when you know how to answer the question. Because if you look for point, evidence, explain, 4 or 5 paragraphs that are just 3 lines. Point, here's my proof about it. And you know, sometimes starting with the quote is really cool. Let's start with that quote. Let's talk about Lady Macbeth when she says it will turn the, you know, the guilt will turn the seeing, or sorry, our act will turn the seeing carnadine. And you stop there and you have that English teacher moment. Incarnadine, what does that mean? It means to turn red. Red with what? Blood. Yeah, you know, you talk about the imagery. And then if they can link that somehow And we've looked at several moments. I know that some exam boards are hinting and moving away from awarding points for direct quotes, but doing that alongside awarding marks for identifying specific moments. So you might not be able to remember what Amelia said to Desdemona when she lied about having the handkerchief, but if you can point to that moment and explain its importance, what happened before, what happened after it, each character's reaction, that might be as good as. I hope they're moving towards that direction, because that helps young people's cognitive load, I guess. You know, you're walking into an exam. If you're walking into an exam and you've got all of these concepts and you're ready to go, if you can maybe slightly overlearn, perhaps a bit contentious, overlearn some quotes really quickly before you go in. That's kind of what happened to the previous student, where he'd done his foreshadowing and his pathetic fallacy. What he didn't really have was why the author was using that. You know, why it's important to an audience member to read. And, you know, so I keep saying audience member because I think very visually. So when I read a book, it's a film for me. I can see it in my head. And because of the way our young people these days are interacting with media, it's so visual that to have this kind of visual language and to use films and plots, because they're all written by people, right? They're all authors, to imagine these pieces as film. Why has the author done this? And they understand then that because I'm no longer seeing sentences like the witches said this to Macbeth. Shakespeare chose this moment for the witches to communicate this. And Banquo hears this and reacts in a certain way. Shakespeare makes Macbeth shudder at this point because, you know, and that way they are showing explicitly to the examiner that they understand that all of these choices are there on purpose, because that is fundamentally what the exam asks. What has Shakespeare done, or what has the author done to convey X, Y, and Z? Make sure you comment on the extract, form, structure, and language. Well, you're going to do that if you're talking about what the writer has done, because you can't talk about what they've done without how they've done it. And if you're going to talk about how they've done it, you're going to talk about the effect. And if you just want to, and if you're talking about the effect really well, guess what? You can put in the place. You can. Mm-hmm. I often say to them, "Where is the only written place for Noah's Ark?" And they think it's a really bizarre question. Where's Noah? How do we know about Noah's Ark? Oh, it's a Christian story. Yeah. Where's the only place it's ever written down? Well, the only place ever written down is the Bible. There's nowhere else it's written down in that specific. And you know, what did the animals go in? Two by two. Some of them, yeah. Some of the animals went in other numbers if they had a cloven hoof. That's right. That's my point, is that you can only get the answer from the book in front of you or the text in front of you. So what you bring into the exam room or what you bring into your lesson is, if the chain begins to work properly, the prior knowledge. Today we're going to start talking about Pride and Prejudice. I'm going to talk about the role of women at the time of Jane Austen writing this, and all of a sudden their brains should click on, hook on, and go, right, I'm now going to be looking for subjugation of women. I'm going to be looking for women to be speaking in shorter sentences, men to be speaking in longer sentences, you know, that kind of thing.
And that's, and you mentioned cognitive load theory earlier as well, and it's absolutely right that by teaching in this way and by ultimately planning your curriculum in this way, the concepts themselves become like cued retrieval, right?
Yeah.
So rather than having to remember all of this knowledge about gender roles that you've picked up over 4 or 5 years, it's all just latched onto this central schema of gender roles. And one memory then feeds into the next. And because it's so linked and well connected, but it's been explicitly connected, right? So your teachers, when they're introducing the next example of this particular concept, they're doing that really explicitly, I would guess, with reference back to the most recent time that they'd encountered that same concept.
Absolutely. And because we're a small team, I'll be able to look back at the planning and go, do you remember when you looked at gender roles in that book in year eight? I think what else is important to remember is when I'm doing all of this work with them, I also teach them about how they learn.
Yeah.
I think that's so important that they themselves understand the process of learning, so that they know that, yes, they've learnt about four different books that have that's broad and deep knowledge, that they don't have to remember everything because it's going to form an island in their long-term memory. And I talked to them about schema, and I say to them, you know, everybody close your eyes. I do this with even down to year five, and obviously you model it differently. But I guess the average one will be close your eyes. Let's go to the cinema. Like, you walk through the doors in front of you. What do you see? And they write it down. What's he wearing? What's on his head? What does it look like? And you know, the amount of kids that come back to me, even they're 11 or 15, it's brown. The scene is brown. There's a man behind a window that's got a hole in it, and he's wearing like a fez or a red and gold hat. And the carpet is red. And have you ever been to a cinema that's like that? No. And what I tried to say to them is, you have this plan of a cinema already in your head.
Mm.
Expect different pieces to be, expect to happen. So if I was to ask you to write about certain things, write about something you've never experienced, you know, going back to that abstract idea, we can't go back to what it was like to be in a freezing cold castle in 1600, but we can use schema, we can use prior knowledge, films, cultural capital, and they kind of go, oh yeah, I didn't think about that. Talking to them in that very obviously differentiated way, once they understand or begin to have an idea of how they learn, it just becomes very, very see-through what I'm trying to do. And they get on board because I'm not trying to trick them. I'm not trying to do a magic trick. It just becomes, look, this is what we're doing here. And I tell them, I'm trying to make you better people. I'm trying to make you experience the world in a better way, because as we said earlier with what Zoe and Sam said, there is intrinsic value in meaning making. It's become like a mantra. Oh, does it matter that the curtain's blue because he's sad? Couldn't it just be blue? No, because it could be velvet. It could be really heavy, just like his emotions. And he could be looking out at the weather and he's really sad and there's a little bit of rain falling down the window. And that's called pathetic flowers. Yes, absolutely. And why has the author used that? These over time, this builds up to, we hope, make sense to. And I'm beginning to see, even just two terms in, I'm beginning to see the change. And for the year 11s, I pretty much did an about turn. I dropped the anchor, turned the boat upside down and went, right, forget everything you knew. This is how we're going to do it from now on. And they just, whether it was because it was a change, so, you know, a rest is good as a change or whatever, and they just went for it because I was coming at it from a different angle. I went, P, gone. Essay structures, gone. You know, PowerPoints about, sentence starters are great. Some, you can have really good sentence starters and scaffold it for them that need it. But particularly year 11, when I turned the boat around in September, they just went for it because I thought, yeah, we're into this. We can get this. And that's when I started to have the conversations about meaning making and about, look, as long as you can stand your ground, and if it comes back and it's a bad mark and I request the paper and I think you've made a good point, I'll stand your ground as well. You know, because I think we've got to take the opportunity to you know, what is it, the musical Avenue Q said, what do you do with a BA in English? And everybody laughs about it because what do you do with a BA in English? But the answer, a lot of things, thank you very much. But also, thank you.
You run marathons.
Yeah, but the whole idea that through one subject, often called the gateway subject, right? You know, chair of governors for a local school, and they're really good at talking about their bucket subjects, but they're really talking about, hang on a second, the history essays aren't great. Their knowledge is great, but the structure isn't. So what's going wrong in their English? What's going wrong in that English input for it to be failing here? And I think, you know, English teachers can be sometimes accused of an arrogance to do with the subject, but it is the subject that bleeds into almost everything. And certainly the most difficult subject I've found to link any kind of concept-driven curriculum through is to maths. Beginning to work on some of that, and some excellent blog posts that have come out recently specifically to do with concept-led curriculum in maths, is looking at it through an English lens, because trying to tell them that you can learn 2 + 2 = 4, brilliant, but you won't be asked that in an exam. You know, Sammy has two sweets, he wants four, how many more sweets does he need? If you can, from an English point of view, realise that the exam has been written in that way, what is the examiner looking for? What is their intention? This text has been constructed. What have they used to try and trick you? What have they used to try and make your brain work that little bit harder? And if you come at the exam question as seeing that it's been written, that it's not just a question to answer, that somebody has written this for me to answer, so it's going to be accessible, I just have to find the way in.
Mm. And so much of that is so interesting just to hear you talk about maths as well, because I often think there is a crossover here between concept-driven curriculum in subjects like English and variation theory, which I think gets much more of an outing in maths and science and those kinds of subjects. But there is a lot of crossover there, because so much of it is about helping pupils anyway to identify where that concept is being represented in a slightly different way and where the similarity is. And that's huge in maths. I mean, particularly I'm a primary school teacher, and it comes up all the time in at the end of key stage two tests when you look at these questions and you go, but that's just this, that's just fractions. Yeah, it's just adding fractions and then subtracting off what the difference between the total and a whole. And it's like, yeah, it is, but it's training them to be able to see the breadth of variation that concept can be represented by. We're going to go to our sponsors again, but when we come back, should we do a little bit of David Ajabel?
Yeah, absolutely.
Marvellous. Okay.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Okay, so Chris, David Ajabel, do you want to lead on this one, or do you want me to explain it? What do you want to do?
No, I'll be a gentleman after you, sir.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you very much. Ajabel's research goes right the way back to the 60s. For anybody that's not familiar with it, and it's his research has been written into one of the Inaction series of books by Sarah Cottingham more recently. But essentially what the research states is that when you introduce a concept, you should introduce it in its most abstract form first. And this is when you're thinking about how to plan introducing concepts and when you're thinking about how to plan the curriculum as a whole. So you'd start off with the concept in its most abstract form, and then you'd get increasingly concrete as you work your way down a kind of a flow chart, really. So you'd start with something really broad at the top, and you think, right, what's that going to look like in year 11? What's that going to look like in year 10, in year 9, in year 8? What's it going to look like? And where are the connections between the different examples of that concept that I'm going to visit as we move children through the curriculum? So how has that kind of influenced your thinking? I know you've touched on it a little bit as we've gone through our conversation already. But yeah, how has that sort of in its broadest sense influenced your thinking around curriculum?
it's one of those things where I didn't realise, having read Azubel's work, that and various variations of it, that his ideas are the way I think learning should occur. So, for instance, definitely he's, you know, very much about his meaningful learning, and that it's more effective than rote memorization, because I try and make my students understand and retain the information better by potentially, it's not fully, and I'm not a researcher, I'm just an English teacher, but I guess if it was, it'd be something close to his subsumption theory. So that's where his theory of that suggests that new information is learned by assimilating it into existing cognitive structures. And so if we've got pre-existing knowledge, people who've been loyal for the past hour and 20 will know we've been speaking about these pieces of prior knowledge. They're aware of kingship and king-making in Tudor and Jacobean times. They know about the struggles of the new Scottish king and worried about all of that. If we can then hook a new bit of learning onto that, by the way, Shakespeare could lose his job and his head if he doesn't convince everybody not to uprise against the king. So he basically wrote a new play. And the idea that the relevant concepts are hidden already in the learner's mind, the process of subsumption, therefore, involves relating this new information that I've given them to what they've already got and then trying to organize it. And that's my job, to help them organize it. And I can do that through, I'm trying to think from memory, conceptual hierarchy, I think Azubel might call it. I might have misspoke, but I think so that's where the knowledge is organized hierarchically, with more kind of general ideas being at the top and more specific details at the bottom, so that meaningful learning occurs when the new information I've given them is integrated into the hierarchical structure at an appropriate level of abstraction, I guess. So, for instance, as an example of that, if I can talk about the idea of Shakespeare being a potential proto-feminist because he's giving Lady Macbeth agency, but at the time, from a knowledge-rich point of view, she would still have been what we would see as a housewife. She was Lady Macbeth, but the roles of a lady in the Jacobean times wasn't how we imagine it to be, with lots of servants running around and not doing a lot. She would have done a lot of the castle work, as it were. And so then you begin to think, well, actually, is Lady Macbeth's ambition for her husband her own ambition as well? Because you never really hear from her as to what she wants. She just wants her husband to man up a bit, right? And so linking that tiny bit of new information, where does that fit hierarchically? Well, that's in the moment, based on the prior knowledge that I already know that the young people in front of me have, I can help them place that in a place that's appropriate. For me, it's not very high order. It's background. It's stuff. It's a bit of fluff at the background that builds up the knowledge rich. And by I like fluff. I mean fluff in a good way. Good fluff, not bad fluff. It adds good fluff. It gives context. It gives knowledge rich, or at least the potential for knowledge rich moments. Because can you imagine talking about Lady Macbeth's suicide within an exam question and linking it back to how her role in society might have determined that? As an examiner, you'd look at that and go, wow, what has this kid been reading? What are they thinking about? So meaningful learning, linking the things that they've already learned, looking at Azubel's theory of subsumption, so assimilation of new concepts into existing cognitive structures. That's the theory of what we were talking about earlier, where I was using language like hang it onto. So the concept of gender roles, we're hanging the schemas and hanging toolkits that the authors might use. And then briefly branching out into kind of possibly looking at more reception learning that he might look at. And that is just simply that students learn better from a teacher, I think. With only 6 minutes to go, I think that's the quickest way I could do reception learning. And look, it's a bit geeky and it's a bit, and I don't shy away from that at all. The research is there, and to discover Azubel's work And be like, this is how I think. This is my opinion as well. Oh, this is what I do anyway. And to realize that you automatically think, do you know what? If a little bit of knowledge is good, more must be better. And they will remember this more if I tell them it's linked to it. So, you know, you can have explicit moments in discovery moments that they can happen at the same time.
Yeah, do you know, and that's beautiful, I think. I love that. This idea that actually through explicit instruction, you can actually create these moments where they make the connection, and the connection is the thing that they discover. Yeah,
because they've thought about it, they're more likely to remember it, right?
For sure. And that's something that, just going back for a moment as well to when you were talking about Ajabel's theory of subsumption as well. So Sarah Cottingham shows that really, really nicely with a Venn diagram. So you've got like one side of the Venn is the existing knowledge. The other side of the Venn is the new knowledge that I'm connecting to it because it's linked. And then the bit that sits in the middle of the Venn diagram, that's the new understanding. So I've got that new understanding by, like you say, assimilating what was already there with some new knowledge as well. And that's where I've got that kind of new understanding from. It's an absolute myriad of brilliance, what we talked about tonight, and I've loved every single second of it, Chris. So thank you so much for your time, and thanks for taking us through the journey that you've been on. What's next, just before we finish? What's the next steps of this? Are you going to branch out into the other subjects across the school? I know you sort of have overall co-curriculum leadership responsibility at your school. What's coming next?
Yes, I think next we're going to move into the world of science and try and look at, with our excellent head of science, we're going to try and at how we can build a concept-led curriculum with science that might look more to do with themes and topics. But I think we've got the head of science looking into it now, trying to find what she thinks are these measurable moments of prior knowledge, what she can do with them. And I think moving forward, if you want to create a concept-led curriculum, you need to have these moments that Ajabel supports. You need to have existing cognitive structures to be subsumed by new material. You've got to have previous concepts sat there ready so we can make meaningful links between them and hang them in a way that makes sense to not only the teacher, but to the student, and that eventually, you know, leads to progress and outcomes, which is what we're here for.
Totally, and you're right. You've got to be deliberate about this stuff, and I think that's one of the key messages that I've certainly taken from our conversation tonight, is that whatever your subject is, you've got to be deliberate about what are the concepts that you're going to try and cultivate an understanding of through repeated exposure to them throughout your curriculum. And then you build your knowledge content around that, and that's exactly what you've talked about that you've done within your English curriculum. But the same will apply to other subjects as well. I've seen it done in primary schools as well as secondaries as well. It really is all about just being really deliberate and explicit about these are the concepts that we care about and value. And so we're going to choose our knowledge from that. Now there's a massive conversation also to be had around, how do you choose those concepts, you know, in terms of thinking about what are our values and what's our ethos, and do our concepts actually come from those, and do they lean on our kind of wider school purpose? Sadly, with only a minute and a half of our show left, we're not going to get onto that. But perhaps another conversation for another time.
Yeah, and I hope that people, if there's something that listeners can take from our show tonight and the podcast episode that kind of follows us in this, but in podcast form, there are moments that they can take that were similar to my own experience. And I think any conversation around curriculum is a brave one to have in school. And no matter your role, if you've got an idea that might better the curriculum for your young people, then go and speak to the person that might be able to make that change happen, and good luck.
Good luck indeed. That is a lovely message to finish with. Chris, thanks so much for your time. Thanks everybody as well for listening along and for all of the likes that we've seen coming in through to the show tonight as well. So again, Chris, thanks so much. And everybody, I will see you again, hopefully same time next week with a brand new guest and a brand new topic.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.